Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Narcy David, food and wine editor for KCBS Radio in San Francisco and your moderator for today. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's also being held in association with the club's Bay Gourmet Forum. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Hubert Keller, chef owner of Fleur de Lis and Burger Bar, former competitor on the TV series Top Chef, and author of Hubert Keller's Souvenirs, Stories and Recipes from My Life. Let me tell you a little bit more about Chef Keller. In 1982, with Roger Verger, one of France's three-star chefs, he opened Sutter 500 in San Francisco. In 1986, he joined Maurice Ruas as chef partner of Fleur de Lis, and that dates back to the 1950s and has always been a favorite. He maintains a Michelin star and the highest ratings from the major reviewers. A fire destroyed the restaurant in 2001, closing it for more than a year. We're going to find out how such an extraordinary French chef even managed to open burger bars along with another namesake restaurant in Las Vegas. Hubert grew up in Alsace above his father's pastry shop, which of course is where it all started. His latest cookbook is a charming memoir titled Souvenirs, Stories and Recipes from My Life. Please welcome Chef Hubert Keller.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you.
Hubert, we've got to start with your childhood, growing up above that pastry shop in Alsace.
Yes, yeah, it was quite an experience, I must say. And it was a patisserie in Ribeauvillé, that's east part of France, a little town called Ribeauvillé on the wine road. And it is true that my parents still live there, and at the first floor, right? And the patisserie now, my brother ran the pastry shop for many years, and then also retired, and then now an old apprentice from my dad took over the patisserie. So it's still in the family business, and then when Chantal and myself, we're going home, we're actually living above on the third floor, right, where we grew up as kids. So it's definitely still the family thing, and the beauty of it, I think, is in the book, like I described, when literally, of course, when you wake up in the morning, it sounds like a fairy tale, but it was the truth. When they were baking the Danish, the brioche, everything downstairs, and it started usually around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Of course, when we woke up at 7, the whole house smelled that way. And I think it's today we're still waking up with that same smell.
That's wonderful.
Wonderful, yeah.
What about some of the meals you had now? Some of those meals you had with your grandmother while your parents were both down below. There's got to be one real favorite thing that dates back to your childhood.
I think when it comes to like a food memory, like I said, one particular dish is a dish called the Bäckerofen. It's the Alsatian dialect, right, which means the baker's oven. And very often when we talk about Alsace, we're thinking mostly sauerkraut, choucroute, right? But that dish is less known, but I must say that is definitely a very authentic dish from that little part of France. And the whole idea behind that dish is it's a three-meat potato stew and three-meat potatoes and white wine. And in the old days, that was the dish that was served on Mondays. And usually Mondays was laundry day. And the ladies in those days still did the laundry on the river. And they still had to do lunch, right, for the whole family. So what they did on Sunday, they would marinate then its beef, pork, and lamb.
All together.
Uh-huh. Cut in little cubes of like that. And they marinate that, of course, with the white wine because the region, that's where they have white wine. And then carrots, onions, I mean, juniper berries. And then the next morning, they had these bigger terrines that were customized because very often they were locally made, right? And so they would put a big layer of sliced potatoes. Then everything that has marinated, vegetables, meats, put a big layer of that. Then, of course, a pig's foot, right? It has to be a trotter in it. So that means that brings the gelatin part of it. Also expanding a little bit the meat, right? So they have can serve more people.
Sure.
And then another layer of potato. Pour, again, the rest of the marinade over. And literally, they take the tureen, bring it to the baker. And what happened in those days, the ovens were still wood-fired. That means in the morning, when all the bread was baked, that's when the baker usually would make one day the meringue, one day he would make the pâte à choux. I mean, everything which is not on high temperature, he would use up the heat of the oven to bake the things and or the pies. Well, on Monday, he would take the leftover dough, and then those terrines had kind of a lid, so he takes the leftover dough, seals the lid with it, and creates a natural pressure cooker, and like in the old days, right, and would put these terrines in the oven. And with that
so then he's baking those off for the whole community, really.
For the whole community, yeah. They would stop by, and like I said, that's why these tureens had to be labeled. Otherwise, they wouldn't recognize who has what. And then at noontime, they would literally come stop by the baker, get the tureen, buy a baguette, put it on an arm, and then walk home, put the tureen on a table, cracks it open, and then you could smell the beautiful. In those days, it was a simple dish, like a peasant dish. But today, I think it's a great entertaining dish.
So do you make that often at home now?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. That dough, and I think we made the, I mean, we make it, when we do entertain, we're introducing that dish to friends that have never eaten the back off, and which is also interesting. It is a great dish to entertain because you can, it cooks for about 4 hours in the oven, but let's say if it's not quite ready or your friends are not ready, just pull it out, let it sit. And then an hour later, you can put it back in. It's not going to go nowhere. And then since you're only putting white wine in it, the potatoes, everything, nothing just falls apart. It still stays layered. So it's a great entertaining dish. And in the wintertime, of course, you can make it fancy. You put little truffles inside if you wish. Or,
well, you know, you got me thinking now about dinners at home and with friends. What about on the nights that you and Chantal are eating alone? What? How do you feel about dinner?
Yeah, usually at home, oh. Chantal is a chef, right?
Lucky guy. You get a day off.
So we don't eat very often home. I must say I wish we would eat probably more often home, but since we're always either at the restaurant and when we have a day off, it's true we mostly are always out. But when we do at home, I think probably that Chantal has a question. It could be either a roasted chicken or something simple, right?
Now, if she's included a question in here, oh, right. I guess I want
to
know.
See if it's right or not. But we keep it fairly simple.
Well, let's bring you to San Francisco. So before we get to San Francisco, though, you've got to learn how to do something more than pastries.
Yes.
After your father's shop, there's a whole string of the greatest French chefs, all three-star chefs. Tell us about that training period that you went through.
Yeah, so when I decided, like I said, when I was 16, my brother already had decided to become a pastry chef. He's 4 years older. So, of course, my dad is a pastry chef and my brother is a pastry chef. Automatically, I wanted to be a pastry chef too. So the idea was to start an apprenticeship, and I went to school with Marc Ebelin, which was the son of Paul Ebelin, the famous three-star Michelin in Alsace, which is in those days was the only three-star east part of France. And also to say, when we talk about three-star Michelin, in those days, there were like 15 or 16 three Michelin. There was no more than that. So it was very restricted. And so when he heard that I wanted to do an apprenticeship, he asked his dad. One thing led to the next. I was accepted at L'Auberge de Lille and to start an apprenticeship in pastry. And so I was very happy, and it was very exciting. But I think the chef probably saw me. For me, it was the first time I really could see what's happening in a three-star kitchen. Although as kids, when we were running around, I was not looking what was really happening there, right? But then when I was working there, I think it took my attention, and I think the chef probably saw that I was probably attracted to what's happening in the kitchen, and he asked me if I would like to then come over in the kitchen. And then finally I spent 4 years at L'Auberge de Lille, and that was really the foundation of where I was working there, and I got everything. But to answer your question about the three stars, in those days, when I came here in 82 in the United States, was the first time I needed a bio, basically, to say where I worked and what I've done, because, and that was for the immigration. They wanted to know, of course. But early on, I think the formula with the three stars, it was like a huge family. It was very hard to get in. I didn't realize that on the beginning, but it was a really hard way to get in. Once you were in that family and once you were performing the way you're supposed to perform and not kind of screwing up in a sense, you never needed to find a job and you were totally taken care of. And after, once you graduated, once you finish your apprenticeship, I remember well when the chef one morning comes in and says, next week, Wednesday, you're going to start at Paul Bocuse. And he says, yeah, chef. And then you don't ask who's going to pay for the traveling, who's going to put you up in a room, no, nothing. You just knew that. And then the chef would call Paul Bocuse, and Paul would say, I have a great guy on my meat station. And basically, we were crossing each other on the road. And so each of them get a new guy, but a good guy, right? And then Paul Bocuse would come one morning and says, oh, by the way, in 2 weeks, you will start at Roger Verger. And you say, yes, chef, and then you go on the road and you just continue. But you were in a family that you never had to worry about anything, right? And of course, in the beginning, you were not much paid, right, in those days. But it was not about being paid. I think it was about learning, really, and it was a certain type of formation that we get and foundation that unfortunately doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it's far beyond any cooking school you could ever have gone to.
Yeah, and especially when we say three-star, what would you learn from one three-star to the next three-star? One is like the other one. It was completely different. In those days, I'm talking like an older guy now, but I say in those days, but what happened is it was really
You're
still...
You're what, 38? No.
That's right.
39, wasn't it?
Yeah, I wish. So... In in those days, every three-star, it was a regional cuisine, right? So what we would learn from L'Auberge de Lille in Alsace would be different from the region of Lyon. And then going to Roger Verger, that was completely different.
Now, that's at Moulin de Mougins in the south.
At the Moulin Mougins.
How long did you stay with him there?
4 years.
And then from there, you came directly here with him to open Sutter 500?
No. So in that time also, I made a stop by Gaston Lenôtre in Paris. And those were, finally, those were the three chefs in France in those days. It was Paul Bocuse, Gaston Lenôtre, and Roger Verger. That was the trio who really exported the French cuisine, right? And they were, of course, criticized in France because they were not often at their restaurants. But on the other hand, they literally exported the cuisine. They were on the road. And they also, what they made is every chef today, if it's in the United States or in Asia or in Europe, if we are where we are and if we're actually sitting here and talking and writing a book or having several restaurants and I recognize and have a TV show or whatever, that they made a difference because I think it was Paul Bocuse who really pulled out the chef from the kitchen. And prior to that, if you think about, if you said, okay, very often you talk with your friends and you said, oh, we went to La Tour d'Argent in Paris, right? And we had the best time ever. And then you would say, who is the chef there? I don't know. Nobody knew. It was La Tour d'Argent, right? And then when you went to Maxime's, everybody knows Maxime's. If I ask anyone here who is the name of the chef there, nobody knows. And I think Paul Bocuse changed that completely around, and then it became worldwide. And I think what happened there is once the thing have changed, if you said... oh, we had dinner by Paul Bocuse, and then you would say, what's the name of his restaurant? Yeah. Nobody knows, right? But there is a name of that restaurant, right? It's L'Auberge à Collonges au Mont d'Or. So it was very interesting how that turned around. And then we as young chefs, then when these three chefs are the ones who branched out, then they really put us on other countries. And so I was... basically sent to Brazil to open his restaurant in Brazil. And again, he would basically call you up or tell you, by the way, I'm opening up something in Brazil. And I remember I came home, and of course we knew it. I knew Chantal since I was an apprentice at L'Auberge de Lille, so it's a long time that we are together also. But I remember I came home, and Chantal was, I must say, was always very supportive on not saying, we're moving again, or we're going again, or what happened to my career, or... yeah, I was always very supportive, but I think when I said to Brazil, it was the first time she was so excited. I said, yes, we go to South America. And that's how then after I operated that restaurant for 2 years in Brazil, and then I came to San Francisco when Roger Verger started Sutter 500.
And that was that became home, San Francisco.
Yes, San Francisco became home. It was not planned to become home because I was supposed to train a chef for 6 months here and then going to Spain to open another restaurant also for Roger Verger. And I remember so well when the night I announced him, it was actually at the restaurant Chez Michel, which at that time was the highlight in San Francisco. I remember so well that when I mentioned him there that I'm not going to go to, especially for the first time saying no. That was a big deal. But he understood because he also traveled when he was young. He didn't show it right away, but later on we always stayed very, very close, right? But it was very important. So basically those 6 months turned into we never left, right? And then 4 years later, operating his restaurant 4 years later, we partnered up with Maurice Rouas and took over Fleur de Lys.
And when he says we partnered up with Maurice Rouas, we really have to recognize Chantal. And what she has contributed to the decor and the ambiance and the pastries and the mood of the place is, it really truly is the restaurant that represents both of you.
Yes, and I think the story is in the book too, is on the beginning when with Maurice and Chantal, when we took over Fleur de Lys, of course, it was the time where California cuisine just in early 80s.
Now, what's California cuisine?
Yeah, well, today we're smiling about probably, but I think it was a good concept. I would say it's a concept like when Nouvelle Cuisine started in France, and we smile about that too, but the concept and the base was great. California cuisine is a cuisine that was born in a chef's kitchen, not in tradition, but it was the idea was basically cooking using the local products and creating your own ideas and putting a cuisine together. And again, many people, I think, jumped on the wagon using the word California cuisine, right, to use it as a vehicle like they use Nouvelle Cuisine in France, and probably they destroyed the whole idea, right? So that's why we're smiling a little bit. But I think the idea was great. But we, when we came, like I said, when we started a restaurant at sort of 500 for Roger Verger and then took over Fleur de Lys, I think that was the moment where it's probably the most difficult part in the country to start a French restaurant, because the French restaurant had to go down basically an inch or two, right, that American cuisine just was born. So many, when we took over Fleur de Lys, many of our closest friends said, the first thing you should do, change that name, because people will not come to that restaurant if you keep it French. And we never felt that way. We kept that name because I think the name was already a little landmark in San Francisco, because many other great, great restaurants, the owners had worked at Fleur de Lys. So we kept the name. And I think we kept the cuisine too, except we made some changes. I think we made the restaurant more approachable. And that was as an experience from Brazil that we learned when I was in Brazil. There with Roger Verger, when we arrived in South America and opened in São Paulo, like the most beautiful, most expensive restaurant, because a very wealthy gentleman was sponsoring us there. Everything was written in French. And if you were from Brazil and you would not, there was not even a translation in the menu. There basically is, it's a little bit abusing, right? So you came to the restaurant, you didn't even know what to order, but that was part of the deal, right? And in the beginning, I felt, well, that's probably the coolest thing. But living then in Brazil for 2 years, learning the language, understanding, we felt it's completely wrong, right? And then coming here, and then starting a restaurant, and in those days also, I think in the French restaurant, the menus were written beautifully in French. And I still think today, when you write a menu in French, it's a little bit more poetic than just in English. I think there's some expression that you can say. But who cares if nobody reads French, right? If you don't get the sense. So I think we were the first ones. We decided we're not even going to translate our menu. It's going to be written in English, so everybody knows, everybody is at ease. And when it says filet Henri IV, and nobody knows what filet Henri IV is, you had to ask. So we would write, it's actually with the artichoke, with the béarnaise, with the pomponneuf. So I think we changed all the things. We changed the tuxedos. Nobody in those days, they all wear tuxedos. We also were the first restaurant in those Fleur de Lys where we had female servers. And as weird it sounds today.
The first one in San Francisco.
First in San Francisco, yes.
In a formal restaurant.
Totally. In 86. And then just to tell you, in those days, like 2 years later, when Massas opened up, just to tell the times have changed, right? Not to criticize Masaz at all, but Masaz in an interview at the restaurant had said, there will never be ever a female server in my restaurant because it doesn't fit in, right? So you could see how where the mentality was, and I think we broke that. We had a female bartender, we had the female servers. So the whole thing changed, and I think Fleur-de-Lis, we never got heard because it was called Fleur-de-Lis, I think, or in the opposite, and I think we took off from that.
Well, now, it sort of sounds like you're saying that California cuisine and French cuisine have come together. How do you differentiate classic French cuisine today from California cuisine today?
Classic French cuisine from California cuisine?
The way it's presented today.
I would say today we don't talk really about California cuisine anymore. I think it's American cuisine, right? And it's California. What happens here? When you buy your product here, but it's mostly. Originally, it started that style of cuisine where the chef, California cuisine was literally where the chef could express himself and not following certain rules and with local products. And that's what Nouvelle Cuisine, it was really what Nouvelle Cuisine was about. Between Nouvelle Cuisine and the classic cuisine was when Auguste Escoffier, an older chef, right, over 100 years ago, when he said the filet Henri IV, or everything we learned in all his three stars, whatever he said, we had to know by heart, and we learned it, and we executed it, right? No expression, really. And then Michel Gérard was the icebreaker, who said, well, I know how to cook an artichoke, for example. I know how to braise it. But how about if I want to put that in or present it with this and make a coulis or a sauce with it? And suddenly there was an expression. And I think through the culinary art, I think it was an explosion and a revolution, right? And everybody wanted to try what that new cuisine is. And, of course, then the same thing happened. People wrote on their restaurant, Nouvelle Cuisine here, and people just would walk in. And I think some were amateurs, and they killed the whole idea, right?
Well, there's no question. And the way the French press dealt with Nouvelle Cuisine was kind of interesting because it became like fashion. I'll never forget going to Taillevant, which was my favorite restaurant in Paris, the year that raspberry vinegar and raspberry-flavored things came along, and I had foie gras that was deglazed with raspberry vinegar. I couldn't believe my eyes that even at Taillevant this was happening. So it just it took over everything. In California, we had red pepper puree became an important thing, and it was red pepper puree served as a sauce over goat cheese, or the goat cheese would be wrapped in grape leaves and grilled and the sauce put over it, or the sauce was added to some broth and made into a soup, but everybody had to have the same thing. And so, in a sense, I feel that the same kind of thing was happening with both French cuisine and what we called California cuisine, which you're correct in saying, of course, is now American cuisine. It got away from the old traditions and established techniques and opened up some
totally.
New ideas.
And the young chefs who then started working in Europe or in Asia, they came back and they literally came up with their own ideas, right, and their own creations. And it's basically like learning an instrument. And when you really know that instrument, you start on composing, right? And I think it was a little bit like that. And suddenly the ingredients were there. It just needed young chefs where the mind is going and then putting some really great things together. And then it worked, right?
So talking about young chefs, where would you direct a young person getting started today? The cooking schools, the TV shows, jobs, what kind of direction would you
I think
offer?
The young chefs, it's a very good question, and we could do a show right on that one, because the young chefs, I think they are a little bit misled what's happening, really. With all the reality shows, cooking shows. I mean, what's really happening, which is totally great for the industry, but I think many jumping in that field because that's what they see. They want to be a top chef. They want to be on TV. They want to be that guy who is discovered overnight, and I want to be cooking too, right? And then, and very often I get that question, right, because when I was judging on Top Chef and competing on Top Chef and even having my own show, right, I think I didn't go into that business because one day I'm going to be running many restaurants, having a cooking show, writing books, right? I think the idea The idea of an apprenticeship in France also, when you enter an apprenticeship, it was to become a cook or like a chef. And then in those days also, the idea, the ultimate dream would be maybe one day I own a restaurant, right? Because if your parents did not have a three-star restaurant, you knew that you will never have a three-star either, because it takes at least two generations to three generations. And Roger Verger was the only chef in France that literally created his three-star Michelin from nothing in 7 years. That was a record, right? And it was a dream for us. And say, we can do it, right? Mm-hmm. One chef did it. It doesn't need several generations. But that was the dream, starting that maybe owning a restaurant, right? It was not do TVs and radios and owning several. That only came after. I think today the young chefs are a little bit, it's a little bit difficult to
right.
for them to understand and why they're entering in that business, because very often then you see them a few years later, they're burned, right?
Oh, well, the average new restaurant lasts 3 years these days. They come and go so quickly, you can't keep up with them.
Yeah, it's true. Right.
Foie gras. What's going on in this world of ours? What do you think about the foie gras ban?
The foie gras ban, it's on one hand, it's kind of sad what's happening or what happened. On the other hand, I could see it coming. I think that whole organization behind, which is like the Friends of the Ducks, I think they literally were able to present a certain angle of how the ducks are force-fed, how they're mistreated, and the whole thing. And, of course, there are two major production. One, as we know, is right here with the... they just closed them, right?
Sonoma Foie Gras?
Sonoma Foie Gras.
Right.
June Gonzalez, which we know since the beginning, right? There was a young couple who were very, very entrepreneurial and started that farm here. And then Hudson Valley. And here it's shut down already, so that's one thing. And then when it's going to go through in New York, right, in Hudson Valley, that's going to be it. So nobody's going to tell you the city or state is not going to support the idea of the foie gras. Not, there's not going to be any foie gras.
Well, do you think the Hudson Valley is going to shut down?
They're working on it really hard.
You mean they're trying to shut
down? Trying,
yes.
They're trying to stop it. They're trying to stop that whole thing. But we could talk about hours about that. Of course, it's a very complicated situation. It's something that is around for thousands of years. Right? I mean, the Greeks already had made already foie gras, and then the Romans learned it from the Greeks. And then when the Romans came up, there's a little battle in France. Who introduced really the foie gras in France? Who started really the foie gras? So, of course, it's Alsace, where I'm from. And then you have the Périgord. These two regions are the producers of foie gras. And we always say, who brought it in? So we have a good excuse, because we say, well, Strasbourg, the origin of Strasbourg was a Roman camp. And when the Romans came up, it's true, they created Strasbourg as a camp to keep the enemies out across the river. And, of course, they brought the whole idea about doing the foie gras, right? So that's how Alsace got it from. But I think it's around for so long that it's almost sad that it disappears, and it's something that we will never experience anymore. And the only thing that I can say is when it comes to the force feeding and how ugly it is, and I always say when you see like the way a chicken is raised, right, it's a total disaster, The thing is like that the farmer probably gets 50 cents for the chicken, right, so it doesn't matter if that chicken dies or not. The person who raised ducks to make a foie gras or geese's, right, gets $30 to $35 liver only. Plus, he sells the bird and sells the breast and sells the fat and everything. So do you really think he's going to mistreat that little animal? He wants to make sure that little thing, the little bird, stays alive as long as it works and as long as it goes. So I'm saying the conditions shown are not exactly the real condition. There were exceptions. There are exceptions.
How do you explain that the restaurateurs didn't do anything with this law? You know, it was 7 years that the law was passed. There was a seven-year... period in which to shut down, and we didn't hear anything from the restaurants until about 6 months before the 7 years were up, and of course it was too late. It just seems surprising that nobody nobody stood up to argue against it during
yes.
that period.
Yes, and I think it's a subject that I think, and I wish we could talk more about, but I think the Friends of the Duck have a way on doing things where we as restaurateurs or chefs cannot hold up. I think it's there's certain ways used against our businesses, which is probably not known. We cannot even talk about, otherwise it's going to fire back again. But I think we've been so cornered that it was not worth to fight. I think we just had to give up. And it's kind of sad.
What about new techniques that are being used in the restaurant industry today? Let's talk about some of these new wave ideas, whether it's right. foams or sous vide cooking, or give me an idea about
yeah, like the molecular cuisine. Or
yeah.
I must say we do a little bit of molecular cuisine in
a little bit of what?
of molecular cuisine.
Molecular.
Yes, it's.
Can you say that in English?
I thought it was English. But I think it's a cuisine which I don't think it's just here. It's not just here for a couple of years. It's going to go. I think again, it's a cuisine. It's a style of cuisine, of course, that I didn't learn. It's fairly new, but it's like another excitement, I think, for certain young chefs who are experimenting. And I think it still needs to be worked on more in details, but chefs who are really mastering it, like if you go to Alinea in Chicago, I think when you go to the restaurant, you really feel and you think you are in another century, right? Because everything is so different. And then some people like it, some don't. I know we went there with Chantal, and even some chefs said, "You're wasting your time in Chicago. Why don't you go somewhere else?" Well, when we left the restaurant, it was amazing. It was totally amazing because I feel like those are young chefs where just by seeing the dishes, the presentation, the utensils, everything that they're using.
Well, describe a couple of the dishes that made
well,
a mark.
One main dish, for example, first of all, when you're starting off, the cocktails are coming. You're not going to drink the cocktail. You're going to eat the cocktail with a spoon because it has been frozen, right, with nitrogen. And then they put some complicated flavors in it. But the whole thing comes together if it's well done. But then there's no tablecloth on the table. And there are little pillows where your utensils are. It's almost like surgery. How are you going to eat that? I'm going to grab it. But again, you think, my God, at least the chef, his mind is going, right? You're almost wondering if he smoked something, right? but it's really well done. But when he came, and then Chantal said, "How come next table, they have a tablecloth? We don't have a tablecloth." Said, "Well, they're probably VIP, right? And we don't have a tablecloth." But then what happened is when the moment comes for dessert, they have like a tablecloth. It's like a thin roll like that, very tight. And then, of course, they're clearing the table completely. And now they're coming with a tablecloth. And it's just, and it just rolls out, right? And then they're setting up on both sides of the table sauces, coulis, fruits, like meringue, all kinds of, like a whole little setup of pastry. And then the pastry chef at every table, pastry chef comes out. He comes out. Our chefs comes out. And now they're starting on drawing and painting on the tablecloths, and they're literally creating art in the middle of the table with all the components. And then at the end, they bring like a frozen meringue cake, they put them on the table, and they heat it, right? And it was frozen with nitrogen, so it breaks like lava all over the table, and everything smokes, right?
Now, this is called Cirque du Soleil?
Totally. Yeah, it is. You know, it's, you know, I must say, it's what in the old days Cherry Jubilee was in a dining room, right, or Crepe Flambé. And I think the show always works, right, in a dining room. I think in the old days, that's what it was. Today, that's what it is. But I think we love to be entertained. I think it's part of what we want in a restaurant. And I think I even played that same game in Vegas when I said we are the first one to introduce nitrogen in Las Vegas. We're doing the smoking to order. We have lots of little tools also. But I feel like that's what it is. What in the old days was that flambé on the table. Today, when you order a cocktail, we're rolling the card over. You pick the cocktail. You can have it on ice or you have it frozen. Then we freeze it for you. And of course, which is amazing, is when you pour the nitrogen, because the whole car, the smoke, everything goes down. It's pretty spectacular. But I must say, so here's the thing. It's not about the show only. When we make ice cream and we make a tableside, and let's say for like an affogato, we literally freeze the ice cream in front of you. So here's the interesting part. We have in the back, we have a Cappuccini ice cream machine, which is like the Rolls Royce of the ice cream makers, right? So totally makes great ice cream. If you have a bowl and you have your cream anglaise and you pour the nitrogen in it and you have a little whisk, it almost sounds really amateurish. And you're going to say, you're really going to make ice cream like that? If I make you the ice cream, it takes about a minute and a half. Suddenly that ice cream comes together. I swear, you taste that ice cream, it's smoother than the one in the machine. That's amazing. So it's not only the smoke, right? It's the presentation, but also then the quality. When we have little smokers where we have little cherry wood and they have a little compressor underneath. And then when we do, let's say, a sea scallop, the sea scallop goes in the plate, everything goes down there, and then we put in the glass dome over. Glass dome has a little hole on the side where the pipe goes in, and now we're lighting the wood.
And you hope it doesn't explode.
It doesn't explode. And then we're literally shooting the smoke through the compressor in the dome, and it's smoke to order, and then comes at front of the guest, and of course when we're lifting up the dome, the smoke comes out. Of course, it's a little show.
Now, is this in Vegas only, or do you do that here
too?
We do
it in Vegas, yeah. So that we are a little different of the restaurant, right? But the bottom line is you're going to be eating a sea scallop, which is smoked. But then when you're moving on to the next course, your palate is not smoked in, right? You had that smokiness. It's gone. Now you're progressing. So it has its advantages.
It's a new world.
It's a new world.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Chef Hubert Keller, chef owner of Fleur de Lis and Burger Bar in San Francisco, who's discussing his life, career, and the art of being a successful restaurateur. And now, having just said that, let's talk about those burgers, because everybody wants to know, how do you go from working with 3-star chefs to opening a hamburger joint?
Yeah, no, you're right.
Tell us about how did this happen?
It's quite a stretch. but it's the way that happened was a pure accident. That was when we had signed a deal with... that was after, actually, when everything was really going well at Fleur de Lis, when we really were on the peak of our times, I would say everything was going well. Then we finally took... You can say all our savings between Maurice and our savings, and we redone the restaurant completely from the earthquake retrofit to a new kitchen, everything. And sadly enough, about 6 months later, we lost everything in a fire. So I think that's what really changed our life and triggered everything else, because the time it took to rebuild, we didn't know if we were going to be able to rebuild, but at least we felt we will have to do something else. The idea was not to have many restaurants, be involved with many things. We were very happy the way Fleur de Lis was going. We operated like in France, you open a restaurant, it's the family, right? No partners, no, it's our restaurant, our building, and if we make wrong decisions, we're paying with our own money, and then we're learning really fast. And so, but then when that happened, that's when we wanted to branch out, and then we're able to then get a deal in Las Vegas when the whole thing started. And at that time, Bill Richardson was the owner of Mandalay Bay and the builder also.
But now that was to open another Fleur de Lis.
That's right. And when Fleur de Lis was under construction, I had brought in the chef already, managers, and then we got a little bit delayed under construction. In the same time, Mandalay Place was opening up, that shopping mall with restaurants, and Bill Richardson called me up one day and said, I need some help because we're going to be opening up in a few months. And he just kicked basically the tenants out. There was an argument. And he said, I have a location. I know you have your manager, your chef. Put a concept in there, and I promise you, he said, as soon the restaurant is ready, Fleur de Lis, either we run it ourselves, I find another operator, and don't let you stuck with it, but just open up something so I don't open that mold.
Just help me get
help something. Help me do something. And that's what we did. And then I was on the phone. That deal was done by phone. And then when we finally went there with Chantal, we wanted to see where that actually located, and we realized that it was much more work than I thought of. So I remember so well, I said to Mr. Richardson, I don't know what we're going to do yet, but whatever we're going to do, I think I'm probably would like to keep the place. And he said, it's yours. because at that time he was building the convention center, so he was way too busy that with some little things. And then we had to find something, and then at that time there was already a brasserie in Mandalay Bay. We were coming with fleur-de-lis in, so we couldn't start a bistro or something. And then the idea, it was Daniel Boulu at that time who launched a burger. And for the ones who remember, it was the DB Burger.
Now that was in New York?
That was in New York. That was in New York. Four-star chef in New York, French, launches a burger, right? And when nobody would even put a name on there. And that was the most expensive burger also. So that was like a...
Excuse me, that was the most expensive burger until you came on.
Yes. And that's something that triggered and said, how about doing a concept with just burgers? And the idea really, it's like about over 12 years ago, that was really the time where an American chef would never put the name on a burger, because at that time, if you, in the industry, if you were like a loser, they would say, just go flip burgers, right? you're not good at anything else. So it was a risk, right, on saying, and then some chefs even said, what do you know about burgers anyway? I said, I don't know anything about burgers. It's going to be a learning experience, but we really put a concept together with the idea on doing the best we can. So building a butcher shop, grinding everything the way the everything is fresh, everything is handmade up to today, right? When you do 1,000 burgers a day, every burger is hand-shaped.
What's your favorite burger on that menu right now?
The Keller Burger. It's actually Buffalo Burger, because everybody asks me...
Is there anything else I can do to set you up a little better? What is the Keller Burger?
So the Keller Burger is a Buffalo Burger and has spinach, has blue cheese, caramelized onions, and a shallot sauce.
All right.
And ciabatta bun. And it's a good burger.
On a ciabatta bun?
Yes.
Where do you get the ciabatta bun?
Also, we have a bakery in Las Vegas who bakes it for us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So because that probably still the French thing, because when we eat something, it has to be a little crunchy in a baguette. So I think the ciabatta one places a little crunchy part.
So then the burger bar really almost came by accident. I mean, you were helping this guy out by filling the space with something, but it's become
a pretty important thing.
You have one there. You have the burger bar here in San Francisco.
And just opened one in Beijing in China.
Beijing and China.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
And I got to go back in 2 weeks.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
But it was a risk in a sense of, I still remember the morning we went there and I put the key in that electric door who opened up, and I really thought that was like the most stupid thing probably could have done, right? Because you're probably going to run into the ground in 3 months. And then when all the chefs came over, supporting the burger bar, and of course I had lots of French chefs then in Vegas, and then the good thing is suddenly they came back, and when I saw them coming back, first I thought it's for the support, then since they came back I knew we had something good. Now we needed the press, and then the press, I was very concerned because I only did the upscale and French, and so they could have easily in those days could knock me down, right? And I guess the press was positive. And then the burger bar took off, and we needed a couple of hooks really to make sure that burger bar takes off and that people talk about. So I, at that time, since Daniel Boulu had the most expensive burger in New York, I felt we're going to have the most expensive burger.
And so, describe that for us.
So I took it from the classic, from the filet rossini, which you're talking about classic, right? Which is a toast and a filet and a piece of foie gras and truffles and a Madeira sauce. I didn't have to invent, I was not trying to invent something out there too crazy. I just took what 450 years just works together, except I put the patty and then put the bun and then the foie gras and the truffles and Madeira sauce. And
well, now, is the filet ground or is it just a medallion of filet?
It's ground.
Filet?
It's
it
a
is
burger.
Ground.
Yeah, it's actually, it's ground, yeah.
Okay.
And it's we're using Kobe for that. And so it's a great burger, but I never expected that we're going to sell it, right? It was on the menu just that people can talk about. But it was amazing that suddenly that burger took off.
And what's the price of that?
It was $60. $60, yeah.
But wasn't there one that had a bottle of champagne that came with it?
Yes, and then the fun things about the burger is when Daniel Boulu heard there was the most... And Daniel Boulu were friends, right? We worked together by Roger Verger, so it was a friendly battle. But when he heard that there was the most expensive burger in Vegas, is actually the Travel Channel interviewed us. They interviewed Danielle and they interviewed me, but they didn't tell either one that we are both in that show. And then they still caught on saying, And I was very happy to say, yeah, Burger Bar has the most expensive burger in the country and the whole thing. And then they show Danielle, and then I say, it's $60. And then they show Danielle and saying, and my burger is $100. And I said, so what do you say? Because I put double truffle on it, right? So that's after that, I thought, I have to come up with the most expensive burger that they're not going to beat. And it became the Fleur Burger 5,000. And that's a $5,000 burger.
Okay.
And then again, it sounded like, and I knew it was designed, it was not just, say, okay, it's Las Vegas, it's silly, whatever. And I knew the press is going to hit on that one in a probably negative way. So what the Fleur Burger 5,000 was, it's still on. It's served at Fleur in Las Vegas. And so it's the ultimate experience about the burger. And the ultimate experience is not only the best burger, but the best wine pairing. And what we did, I think the best wine pairing is a bottle of Petrus, because it's the only bottle that when you open a Chateau Petrus, you smell the truffles, and that's where the truffles come from. So the idea was, if you order the burger, you get a bottle of Petrus. In those days, we sold that bottle at $5,300. It was a 95 on our wine list. So I brought down the bottle, $5,000.
And gave him a free hamburger.
And a burger's free.
All right.
And he was a success.
The most expensive free hamburger on earth. A lot of people want to know about your guilty pleasure. When you decide to cheat on food, where do you go? What do you do?
Vanilla ice cream? I would say,
no,
as
that's
an item.
No, that's not cheating. You got to be more. Unless you sit down and eat a whole quart of it at a time.
I eat it every night. No, but when a guilty pleasure, I love meats. Yeah, it's true. I can eat a big tomahawk if I have to, right, with some béarnaise sauce. But when we're talking guilty pleasure or things, it is simple. It may be too simple, but if it's a real good vanilla ice cream, and when I'm in the restaurant, when everybody's gone, I never leave the restaurant before making a stop on the fridge. And then, of course, my wife is not around, so I eat that. Otherwise, she would say. But, big bowl of vanilla ice cream is definitely a guilty pleasure.
Anything on it or just the ice cream?
Mostly ice cream.
Talking about the restaurant business in general, you obviously eat out in restaurants plenty. What's your biggest concern or pet peeve in restaurants? What troubles you with this? Maybe what I'm really asking is a generational question, you know, with the way restaurants are going now.
Yeah, I think the restaurants are going well. I think in general, we hit the bottom, and the bottom of the wave, right, and in general in the whole country. And I think you could see it's building again. You see in San Francisco how many new restaurants are popping up. So it's almost like in the old days when always new restaurants open up. So it's a good feel, a good sense. So that's a good thing. As a concern, being a restaurateur and having several restaurants, I think the most complicated part is the labor. The labor with the labor laws and the exposure we're having, people who we are always exposed to a lawsuit. And you can be the most strict person or try to do the best. They always find somewhere a lawyer who... Basically, they see there's money to take somewhere, right? If we only had the little restaurant, there would not...
But that's not an issue that's exclusive to restaurants. That sounds like the litigious society
yes.
that we've become.
Yes,
that happens
totally.
No matter where you go. But I mean, when you go into a restaurant, let's talk about some of the new young chefs. One restaurant that recently added a liquor license, but the only drinks you could get are those drinks that are listed on the menu that day. In other words, you can't say, I'll have that, whatever the bourbon was, Knob Creek bourbon. I'd like that Knob Creek with a dash of Angostura on the rocks. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not on the menu. But they have the Knob Creek bourbon and they have the Angostura, but there is only one way you can have it.
And you want to know what I think about?
Yeah. Well, what's happening here?
It's completely wrong. It's because they're too young, not experienced, and we will see where they are in 3 and 5 years from now. Because I think in the industry we're in, if you're young or older or whatever, the industry we're in, I think it's to fulfill pleasure and creating an ambience to guests who are coming to the restaurant. It's not only about the food. It's only not about the wine. It's about the whole thing the moment you walk in. Right. And when you leave and somebody shakes your hand and says thank you, looks in your eyes, you know if that was sincere. And you touch them, right, for like 2 or 3 hours. But telling them, I mean, there's a restaurant, I won't mention names, there's a restaurant in Vegas which is known and kind of successful. And same thing like you said, if you can have a cocktail, but once you enter the restaurant and you order a cocktail, they literally ask you to leave, right? Because the chef said, my food doesn't go with cocktails. You drink wine or nothing, right? So those are attitudes when you say you have a bunch of young group who goes to Vegas, they're hanging out, the place is cool, it's loud, it's happening, and you order a cocktail and they ask you to leave the dining room. I think that's so wrong, right?
Hubert, I really think the key here is the word restaurateur. Simple French word means restorer.
That's right.
We go to a restaurant to be restored, to be taken care of, and now suddenly there's a generation that I don't think understands that word restaurateur.
I think those are these premature chefs, right, who like chefs with an attitude. I think we as French sometimes we are known also to have an attitude, right, who had an attitude, right? where the chef, when the waiter comes, and the thing, same thing, wasn't that for a while it was very popular that when the waiter would bring something in front of you, he gives you the instruction how to eat that dish and how the chef wants you to eat it and how to taste it and go around instead of just having it. I think that's an attitude, right? And it can work for a little while, but after a while, I think when we're all going out, we want to be entertained, we want to have a good time. Mostly we want to have that good time, right, around good food and when it's happening and the wine, but not being taught. Oh, it's like I said, it fires back to the time where you come to a French restaurant, and I experienced that, where we did it in Brazil, where it was only written in French, and if you don't read French, too bad, right? Mm-hmm. Then you have to ask the maître d'. The maître d' was Brazilian. He was not reading French either, so he couldn't explain what was on there. But it worked. It was the most expensive. It worked for a while. After that, you have to change it, right? Because there's a moment people turn their back. And I think today, yeah, what happened in certain of these places is kind of silly. I think we are arranging, I think at Fleur de Lis, we always did it. Just an example to accommodate. There's only so much we can accommodate, but I think we accommodate if we have a tasting menu. And that goes back now, we're talking about 10, 15 years ago. You have a tasting menu. First of all, not the whole table has to have it at that time. Then if someone was vegetarian, I think I was kind of known also to be one of the first chefs in the country, upscale restaurant, who did vegetarian tasting menus, right? I started very early on, over 30 years ago, right? And so you could have a vegetarian. If somebody was on a Dr. Ornish diet, I would do the Dr. Ornish. I would do the vegetarian. If there's a vegan on that table, he gets vegan, and then the person who wants a big foie gras and a big piece of meat gets it too. And I think we were known for that because that was accommodating the guests.
It's called service. It's called,
I think so,
being a restaurateur. Yeah. We haven't talked much about wine. We've got that bottle of Petrus in there for $5,300 that got discounted. A free hamburger thrown in. How do you feel about California wine and what's been happening with California wine relative to the world of wine?
Oh, it's amazing. I think since we arrived in 82, that's when we came to the United States, directly to San Francisco, not another place. I could feel already at that time what was really happening to the wine industry, right, in the wine country, and also to everything else in matter of produce and everything. But I think what is amazing that when we're comparing wines like in Europe or in France or in Italy, where for thousands of years we make the wine, right? And we're known for it. And it's amazing from in 30 years what happened here, right? And you can see all the young, in particular, like the younger sons from all the chateaus from France or from Burgundy, right? They're all coming here. They're working here. They're learning here.
A few daughters, too.
A few daughters. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But that was another thing, yeah. Because in those days, it was a man's, right. Totally a man's domain, right? So I think what happened in California is at all amazing, right? But I think it, if I remember well, and you probably know more about Narcy, and definitely when it comes to that part, I think it started when during that blind tasting at the Vin Expo in Bordeaux, right, where they knew in France, they knew there was wine produced in California, but and everybody else in Europe, right? But it was still a little bit whatever, it's very far away.
Oh, you're thinking the Judgment of Paris.
Yes.
And that was in Paris.
Oh, it was in Paris, or it was in Vin Expo, when finally there were California wine.
Five California Cabernets and five California Chardonnays and five red Bordeaux and five white Burgundies.
And then the surprise was when everybody guessed it's a Chateau Cheval Blanc, Chateau Ozone, or whatever, was a California wine, right?
And well, the most fascinating thing for me about that was that the press went into the wastebaskets and collected the scorecards afterwards, and they judged the wines on the 20-point scale that was created at UC Davis as a training mechanism for students. And many of the wines had scores of 5, 7, 9 points. Well, clearly every wine in this judging would have been 17 to 20 points. I mean, these were the greatest wines in the world. So we can only guess that the judges found something that wasn't quite right. They figured, well, this must be the California one, and they dinged it. Now, that's a Californian talking, but that was an interpretation of what we saw.
But I think that was really when suddenly California was on the map, right? And
absolutely.
And to explain also where, not to find an excuse for French people, right? But I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you an example when it comes to wine, even 15 years ago, no more than that. I'm from Alsace, of course. We're producing some fabulous wines, I think, in Alsace, and it's recognized now. But in France, when you were in a three-star 15 years ago, I can guarantee you, there was no Alsatian wine on the wine list. It was not recognized as a wine. It was not recognized as a serious wine. It has to be a Bordeaux, has to be a Burgundy, and they were ruling France and every other region. So it was not even another country. Every other region was completely out, right? They wouldn't even look at them, right? So that's how tight it was, right?
Tradition.
And now everything opened up. I think now Alsace wine is on every wine list and it's appreciated, but that was even in the country, right, where there would not be. The time I worked by Paul Bocuse, the time I worked by Roger Verger, zero wine from Alsace. No listed. It's like we were not existing.
Not even a wonderful Gewürztraminer.
No.
Amazing. Let's talk about people cooking at home, because after all, this is a cookbook that you've just written. We've hardly talked about the cookbook. We're
bringing
back the memories that you talk about in the book. What sort of quick little bits of advice can you give the home cook? What are we doing in our homes that makes things too complicated or too simple or mistakes? Give it a little direction.
I think mistakes are not happen. I mean, it's probably not mistakes. I think sometimes people maybe try a little bit too hard when they're trying to cook at home because they watch the TVs, because they watch the shows, they watch what's happening. So I think they try to a little hard. They're a little too hard on themselves when they're trying to go somewhere and then it doesn't happen. And I think then they're disappointed. So that's probably an issue. I think it's easier to take it easier when you try a dish when you're pretty new in it and keep on working with it without right away trying to reproduce that chef that you have seen on that competition, right? I think that's probably one thing. On the other hand, since we're talking about those TV shows, talking about the industry, talking about the United States, when we're talking about Top Chef, the show, right, the reality show, who would have known that when that show, first of all, when the show started, the first episode, the first film, was at Fleur-de-Lis. That's where it started.
Uh-huh.
The first episode, the first show, was at Fleur-de-Lis, when nobody knew, the producers included, right, and all of us, where it's going to go and how it's going to take off. And then when you see a couple of years ago, it's the winning reality show of all the reality shows, and it's a cooking show. Who would have thought 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that a cooking show becomes the best reality show, right? So, and it filters down into the, because we're talking about what people cooking at home, it really filters down into the families to the point where it's amazing, because we get the experience at the restaurant when sometimes now the parents bring more their kids to the restaurant as an education. The kids, sometimes it happens, I'm standing in the front, the couple walks in, the parents walk in, and they have a little boy, a little girl with them, and the father, and he sees me in my whites, so he says, I must apologize. I don't know exactly who you are, but we are here tonight because my son said you were on Top Chef, and we should go. And we should go to fill the list. It's really true, right? It's true. And then you have some kids when they're eating, and they said, oh man, and we're watching Top Chef, and we found the whole thing, and on Wednesday night it's Top Chef night at home, and mom is Padma. So it's like you almost. But it filters in, and I think it enhances people to cook at home. It's a whole phenomenal thing, which is excellent.
Cooking at home, watching TV. What if you were today to create a whole new TV cooking show? What would you want to do that would make it any different from anybody else?
The one that I'm doing.
No,
no. I think no. The question was. The cooking show that I have on PBS is now started the fourth season.
Right.
We're just filming another 26 shows.
But so if you were to do something new, something different, just to break
but
away.
But different, I think it's hard to make something different. I felt that show is successful because I'm doing the difference from all the reality shows and the cooking shows. On that show, I'm cooking. And I'm sharing tricks. I'm sharing recipes. I'm literally cooking at the home recipes that you can do at home. And I think that's why, in a time where it's not easy to have a TV show that you find sponsors and money, right, and to keep the viewers. So in that time, they build my own kitchen now. I have my own set. It gets bigger and bigger. I think it's because the difference, it sounds probably easy, but I think there's so many shows where you cook traveling, you know, all these guys, right, who have their own show, they show so amazing things, but very often, I think what the viewer is missing is one chef who really shares recipes, techniques, and tricks. And then otherwise, I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't put too much smoke and nitrogen on TV yet.
So what should we go out and buy in the grocery stores today? Give me a menu that somebody can make at home right now with what's available on the market tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Quick suggestions.
I think the tomatoes out there, so of course.
Wait a minute. Tomatoes are still coming from Mexico.
No. We still have some tomatoes. They even grow in Las Vegas, believe it or not. I think that the simplest way, and that's also interesting, I think when we talk about what would I buy today to go to the market, that tells you how things have changed. What people buying at the farmers market and what they do and how the couples go out. I think when we talk about farmers market in France, it was only grandma who would go to the farmers market, right? Because she was actually cooking for the family, and going to the market, it was not the they were all farmers, so it was not the farmers market. The market was with farmers. It was the only market in the little square. I think grandma used to go to see the farmers, not just to get the produce, but actually to get the news, because that's what happening. That's why all the elderly ladies were at the farmers market to get what was happening. That was part of the deal. Today, the difference, I think, on the farmers market here, you see almost only young people going out there. So that tells you they're cooking, right? So that's an exciting thing. What makes me smile sometimes on some of these items, when you see them buying some ingredients, I look at these ingredients, I have to think myself what I would do with it, right? Yeah. But they're just buying them. So it makes me smile because I feel like they're going to experiment at home if it's going to work or not going to work. But I think it's exciting because they really are challenged and they want to be challenged. And they're going into it, which 15 years ago, they would have walked by, would have ignored. So that tells you how things have changed. And they're literally reading a lot. They're getting excited about a lot of things. And again, I must say, TV, again, has brought lots of knowledge.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and I love this. Someone writes, my first Beurre Blanc was at Fleur de Lis in the 70s. Can't remember the excellent chef. I make it with sorrel. What's your favorite Beurre Blanc, or describe what you would do with Beurre Blanc today?
What I would do with Beurre Blanc today? I mean, sorrel is a good idea, right? That was like from the classic, from the salmon that Trois Gros had
right.
created in Rouen, right?
Yes.
It was a bit more cream in it, but that was the idea. A Beurre Blanc today, I probably would. I must admit, we don't do Beurre Blanc at the restaurant, right? We don't. It's true. But if I would do it probably at home for fun, maybe I would flavor it with verbena, or something a little bit different, right, than just adding sorrel or parsley or cilantro. Maybe if it's with a fish, I wouldn't mind putting a little bit of vanilla bean in it, because that would work also with sea scallops. So, or maybe it would do a beurre blanc and making a little red wine reduction, that I would cook in the red wine with little shallots. So make sure that the shallots completely soaking in the red wine, and then the last moment put that into the beurre blanc. Right?
Of course, it's no longer beurre blanc if it has beurre rouge.
Nobody, it will only be a little confetti in there. It still would be beurre blanc, right?
Hubert, this is wonderful. We could spend the rest of the night talking.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Our thanks to Hubert Keller, chef owner of Fleur-de-Lis and Burger Bar, former competitor on the TV series Top Chef, and author of Hubert Keller's Souvenirs, Stories and Recipes from My Life. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's also been held in association with the club's Bay Gourmet Forum. I also want to remind everyone here that copies of Chef Keller's new book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign books outside this room immediately following the program. We appreciate your letting him make his way to the book signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Narcy David, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you, thank you.
That was good.
Thank you, everyone, really, for coming. Thank you.